Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and our topic to begin the show is ageism in healthcare. And our guest, Andrew Stewart, has done a lot of work and research in this area. He's an assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee. Andrew is also a licensed clinical social worker. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What are you wondering about ageism? Have you experienced age-based discrimination in the healthcare setting? Tell us how you think we could stop it. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Andrew Stewart, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I imagine there's some sort of legal definition or maybe of ageism. How do you define it?
Well, the definition of ageism is pretty simple. It's any prejudice, bias, or discrimination based solely on someone's age. So I actually think that's important to define ageism simply because it doesn't only affect older adults. There's actually a lot of research showing that ageism can affect younger people too.
Yeah. Maybe give us some examples of age-based discrimination in the healthcare field. You've certainly looked into it.
Yeah, there are many types of ageism. So we can think about the different types at different levels. So at kind of a more macro level, there is institutional ageism, which refers to the laws, policies, norms, and practices of institutions that unfairly restrict opportunities and systematically disadvantage people based on age. And an example of institutional ageism is that it actually wasn't until 2019 that the National Institutes of Health required that older adults be included in clinical trials. Some other examples are that only 2% of hospitals have geriatric emergency departments, and only 5 out of 145 medical schools have geriatric departments. So those are some examples of ageism in institutions.
Well, and you've talked about it in terms of economic loss. How is ageism related to economic loss?
Yeah, so it's interesting because a lot of ageism is really rooted in our own fears of aging. And then economically, you know, ageism is kind of rooted in this fear that older adults are a burden on our economy. However, the research shows that ageism is associated with 17 million cases of the 8 most expensive health conditions in the United States, which when you put that to numbers, that was ageism is associated with 1 year economic cost of $63 billion. Ooh. Or another way to put it is 1 out of every $7 spent on those 8 most expensive health conditions in the U.S. So even though a lot of ageism really comes from our fear of aging and fear of older adults being a burden on our economy, the fact is that if we address ageism, we can actually save a lot of money. So
Mike is driving along in his semi and has a comment. So before he gets out of range, let's get Mike on the air. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I think I experienced what you guys were talking about here. I lost my brother to lung cancer, and my provider said that maybe, you know, I should be taking this test just to make sure that I'm okay. And I waited for an appointment and waited, and several weeks went by, nothing happened, and I called his office, and I was informed that because I'm 78 years old, that it's the test is no longer available for me had I been 77, they would have gave me the test. I guess they're just sticking me to the curb and writing me off because I'm 78 years old.
Oh, boy. Well, Andrew, I'm sure you got a comment on that.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for medical providers to make recommendations based on someone's age. In a lot of cases, I don't think it really makes sense. Like Mike's example, you know, whether you're 77 or 78, why should that make a difference? I really think it comes back to the patient themselves should be the ones to, tell their doctor what they need, what matters to them. And another example is that some of the guidelines around mammograms are that generally older women should get a mammogram every year as long as they have a life expectancy of 10 years, which I'm not sure how exactly anyone defines whether you have a life expectancy of 10 years. But even if you had a life expectancy of 9 years, why wouldn't you get a mammogram? I don't quite understand that. Maybe I'm missing something. Mike's example is a really clear example.
Yeah, Carol in Green Bay has something for us as well. Carol, hello.
Hello. Hello. I found something that I observed myself. I had the same family doctor for 30 years, and I had an annual physical every year, complete physical, undressed, head to toe, entire exam. And all of a sudden, when I turned 65, I got weighed. I had my blood pressure checked. I had my nurse ask me a few questions. I remained fully clothed. My doctor came in for just a few minutes. He listened over my clothing to my heart and lungs, pushed around on my abdomen, asked me if I had any problems, and out the door he went. So the examination when you're Medicare age is quite different. It's not as thorough. And echoing what Andrew said, you have to bring up problems to your doctor because they're not going to go looking for anything once you're 65. It all changes.
Hmm. Comment on that, Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, another very clear example of ageism. Again, the age of 65, as if that really should make a difference in how thorough your physical is, doesn't make sense to me. I think it's just rooted in ageism because there's this really irrational assumption that older people are, you know, maybe have already lived a long life, and so they shouldn't receive the same amount of comprehensive healthcare services. It really doesn't make sense. I mean, people are living longer and healthier lives anyway. Why are we using age as a determining factor for the amount of care people receive?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Carol, for calling. And Mary Kay in Kenosha will give you a chance. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. Institutional ageism has been going on for a long time, okay? I remember in the 90s, I was in my 30s, and I was in a nursing program. They took me out. They put other people in from other countries, okay? We are a threat. Older people are a threat to the drug companies, doctor appointments, and that's why there's ageism. It's because they're afraid. The schools are teaching doctors how to push pills instead of nutrition. So we are a threat to the drug company.
Andrew, what do you think about that? Thank you, Mary Kay.
Well, I think that's a good point. You know, it might come a surprise to a lot of listeners, but Medicare actually, this is another example, Medicare actually doesn't cover hearing or dental or routine vision exams. So that doesn't make sense either. And why would they do that? Well, it likely is the cost, right? Because pretty much everyone, really of any age, needs that kind of health care. But trying to save costs, but really not supporting older folks.
How long have researchers and social workers known about ageism in the healthcare field? Is this kind of a new thing or not?
Yeah, you know, ageism is a topic that has been coming of age, so to speak, more recently. I don't think it was really talked about too much. One of the first researchers to talk about it and define it was Robert Butler. I believe that was back, forgetting the exact date, but around 1971 or so.
Sure.
It wasn't really until recently that people started talking about it more and talking about ageism kind of within a conversation of social justice as well. And so that's something else that's being talked about a lot more. How does ageism intersect with other social justice issues like racism or sexism or discrimination that LGBT folks experience? So all of these kinds of conversations are happening a lot more. There definitely is a growing movement, but we need to really advance the discussions that we're having to bring more awareness.
And, you know, just listening to our callers so far, you get such a when you get negative feelings like that as a patient, to me, that would have some impact on health, on your own health.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of ageism. So one of the types of ageism is called internalized ageism. So it's this idea that, you know, if an individual comes to believe that some of the myths or stereotypes about aging are true, it can kind of be a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, for example, if an older adult or really anyone of any age believes in the negative stereotypes around aging, and it causes them to think that it's not worth it to engage in healthy lifestyle, you know, that can create a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of our health outcomes. So, the way we perceive our own aging is directly related to a number of health outcomes.
And I think ageism is widely accepted. Is it not? And I think it's also kind of hard to see sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is very prevalent and largely accepted, largely unchallenged. Again, I think because it's a somewhat new topic for a lot of people, we really haven't been talking about it too much until recently. So I think that, you know, there's a lack of consciousness around it. It's interesting for me in some of the work that I do. It's not uncommon for me to hear when I talk with older adults, sometimes they say things like, well, I don't think I've experienced ageism. But then as we talk more about it, we learn more about it, provide examples, they share with me later, oh, actually, I have experienced ageism. So it just shows that, you know, education, learning more about this topic can really help to kind of unveil the reality that is all around us.
And just going along with your comment, your last comment there, I think just discussing it today is going to be, I think there are probably going to be a lot of people or many people who are listening who might just say, oh, yeah, I guess that is ageism. We can give some more concrete examples as we visit with our guest, Andrew Stewart. He's an assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee. He's also a licensed clinical social worker and has a paper out, Age Discrimination in Healthcare, The Argument for a Multi-Level Intersectional Response, a really interesting paper. I read it, and we have it up on our we'll have it up on our page today. If you go to talk at WPR.org/Larry, you'll find it under today's date, a link to it. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Andrew Stewart. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at ageism in the healthcare field with our guest, Andrew Stewart, Larry Mueller here. And I'm hoping you'll join in with your own experiences. Have you experienced age-based discrimination in a healthcare setting? What are you wondering about ageism? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk at WPR.org. I was thinking about my own experiences. I guess it's not always apparent, but sometimes it'll be apparent with maybe somebody new in the healthcare field that I might be working with, and they notice my own age and so forth. And I have coped with it a little bit by dropping in somewhere along the line that I'm working full time and I have a radio show, and it does seem to make a difference almost right away in how people, a particular individual might respond to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of our values in our society are based on, being productive members of society, contributing to the economy. So, sometimes those first impressions or stereotypes related to age can be counteracted by demonstrating that older adults are contributing, continue to contribute in a variety of ways in later life.
Does seem to be kind of widely accepted, though, doesn't it? Well, ageism. I mean, and so a lot of times hard to see.
Yeah, it is widely accepted. It is hard to see, which is why I think if we provide more education and talk about it more, we'll learn to see it more.
Yeah. And you'd think in the healthcare field, it would be just the opposite. You'd think people in the healthcare field would be clued in.
Yeah, well, I mean, that goes back to the fact is that only 5 out of 145 of our medical schools in the U.S. have geriatric departments. Less than 10% require geriatric training. In my field in social work, there's been research showing that only about 1 in 10 social work students have expressed a clear interest in working with older adults. But the reality is a lot of social workers work in healthcare settings, and 90% of healthcare social workers work with older adults. So we really need to ramp up the training across the board for all medical professionals to have competence in working with older people.
Yeah. Susan in Monona will give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling, Susan.
You're welcome. Nice to hear your voice, Larry. I have several examples, and I first noticed ageism taking my parents in for doctor appointments and having a healthcare professional direct everything to me. So I would not make eye contact with them, and I'd look at my parent so they would address them. And another thing was when I turned 65, it was similar to what another caller said. Suddenly I'm not being touched other than a very cursory listening to my lungs, looking at my throat. And if I brought something up, I heard the phrase many times, well, as we age, this is normal. Whereas in the past, there might have been more testing or curiosity or exploration.
Susan, thanks a lot. She raises a few points here, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. Those are great examples. And similar in some ways to prior callers. I want to address this as we age, or sometimes medical providers will say, well, that's normal at your age, which is kind of, it's dismissing very real concerns about our health, which can lead to under-treatment. But on the flip side, sometimes medical providers can make assumptions that people need a treatment simply because of their age. So that can lead to over-treatment. So that's unfortunate that both of those issues can happen.
Pat emailed us, and she says, Pat, age is just a number, and wonders how much of a role do the insurance providers play in affecting our views and attitudes?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm not sure that I've looked too much into insurance other than, as I mentioned, Medicare, unfortunately, does not cover dental or hearing, and then also doesn't cover routine vision exams. And then also, in terms of a lot of the insurance supports for older adults are based in Medicaid. And so we've got kind of this patchwork of, you know, Medicaid type of supports for older people. And, you know, it looks different in different states. It's not streamlined. So I think we really need Medicare for all. This is a great example of why I think we need Medicare for all. And we need to advocate for new legislation. So I want to mention there's currently a bill that's been introduced called the Medicare Dental Vision and Hearing Benefit Act. There's also legislation called the Medicaid Dental Benefit Act. So these are legislations that people can, you know, advocate for to make things better for older adults.
Dennis emailed, I think with some experience on this, some ageism is, you can read it in outdated medical textbooks. These things can be taught in medical schools. Clinicians believe so-called facts are eternally proven.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, it speaks to why it can be problematic to make a decision about someone's care simply based on a number, their age. And again, people are living longer and healthier lives, so we do need to update, you know, the recommendations. Also, you know, there's different theories to why ageism has come up in our society. One of the theories is, you know, based in the biomedical model of care. And that sort of contributed to this narrative of aging as just decline, physical decline. So I think it's important that we need to think about older adults and all people, you know, as aging is something we're all experiencing from the time we're born. It's the one thing that we all have in common. It's not just physical. Yes, there are real changes that can happen as we age. It's important to acknowledge that. But, you know, aging is not just physical. It's also social and spiritual. And, you know, there's a lot of aspects to our aging. So thinking about and talking about older people in a more holistic way can help us to have more positive views of older people.
Yeah. I should mention later on in the show at our next segment, we're going to be talking about falls and how to avoid them. And so I'm looking forward to that as well. Tim in Whitewater has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, your guest mentioned Medicare for all, or some people call it universal health care. And I've been told by people from who have visited other countries or have family there that even in other countries that have universal health care, like Canada and Great Britain, Australia, or Europe, there's always a secondary market for insurance, secondary coverage that, you know, covers stuff that, you know, that are some of the supposed negatives about universal health care. And I wondered if your guest had any knowledge of that or any thoughts on that.
All right, Tim, thank you. Andrew, any thoughts?
So Tim mentioned secondary coverage. Not sure exactly what that is referring to. So I know there are different types of, you know, there's Medicare Part A, Part B, Part D, there's Medicare Advantage plans and in the U.S. And so, you know, that's our current Medicare system is far from perfect. And so, you know, simply advocating for Medicare for all is not going to solve all of our problems, because we do need to tighten up and offer more comprehensive services through Medicare itself. So, yeah, that's important to acknowledge. So thank you to Tim for bringing up that question.
Lynn emailed us. She says she believes she has experienced ageism. She's a 61-year-old woman, employed full-time, and considers herself internet savvy. She researches her own medical issues on an accredited website. At her doctor visit, she poses her questions and concerns regarding the choice of treatments. And her doctor scolded her and told her she should ask her questions and not do her own research.
Wow. Well, that is not good. So, you know, if possible, if you currently have a medical provider that's scolding you, telling you not to do your own research, I hope it's within the realm of your possibilities to seek out a different medical provider, because that does not sound like a positive relationship with that provider.
Yeah, for sure. Patricia in Milwaukee will give you a chance. Hi, Patricia.
Aloha, Gary. I'm so upset. Aloha, Larry and guests. My concern is a well-known hospital here in Milwaukee treated me after I fell on a vacation in Europe, and they treated me and discharged me twice. I went back to the hospital for surgery, and following surgery, 2 days later, I had a grand mal seizure, which is currently called a tonic-clonic. I was discharged from the hospital instead of staying at the hospital rehab, and I went to a home, my home, with no food, nothing in the refrigerator, no wheelchair. And I went to a neurologist who is independent of that hospital, and he said, had they treated me the first time and the second time, they should have hospitalized me and treated me to prevent a seizure.
Boy, Patricia, thank you for calling. Come in, Andrew.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing your story, Patricia. You know, I think part of what Patricia's story highlights is that we really don't have adequate supports for people around health-related issues for at their homes. So, you know, a lot of people really prefer to age in place. And of course, a lot of people, as Patricia's example highlights, you know, we all at times have to go to a hospital, see a doctor, we might have to get surgery, and then come back home. And this is a huge area that's lacking in our healthcare system, is providing supports for people at their homes, in their communities, and that sort of continuity of care from hospital back to home. So, that's a really, thank you for Patricia for sharing your example. I'm really sorry that happened to you.
Me too. I appreciate it very much, Patricia, and thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@wpr.org. I did want to get into a few more aspects of your paper, Andrew. You mentioned the word elder speak, and maybe you could talk about what you mean there.
Yeah. So elder speak is basically baby talk. So talking to an older person in an infantilizing way. So some examples are using terms like dear or sweetie, using simplified language, a sing-song tone, or immediately talking louder with an older person. So assuming that they need you to talk louder rather than asking them, you know, are you hard of hearing? Would it be helpful for you if I spoke louder or slower? So making those assumptions in a way that affects the language we use and how we actually speak with older people.
So in other words, you should speak the way you'd speak to anybody else.
Exactly. Yeah. You can always ask someone, just like anyone of any age.
Yeah.
You know, and ask them, what would be helpful in the way that we communicate?
Yeah, absolutely. Kathy in Middleton will give you a chance. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. I am so thrilled. I was driving home from a doctor's appointment when I heard your show. I am old. I am so old. I'm too old to be alive, according to my former provider. What I should say is I am old, and I'm retired, and I had a fantastic job that used my mind, and I used it well. Okay, I had an accident, broke my back, had another accident, broke my hip, had another accident, broke my femur, all unrelated. I still am in recovery after years, but I'm treated as if I'm a drug seeker because I have pain. Of course, when you're in pain, chronic pain, you're a drug seeker. Okay, so here this former primary whom I must say I liked him. I really liked him very much. He was telling me he wanted to send me to a SNF. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do in a SNF? I'm going to sit there and I'm going to die. Because it was, you know, there's no intellectual stimulation there. You're old and you're just expected to look forward to tapioca pudding and bingo. And I'm just so angry the way I am treated and minimized and marginalized because I am old. They don't stop to think, what can this woman do for society? What can she give? What does she need? And I, no disrespect to your guest, social workers, in my estimation, are a scourge on the society because they want to put you in a program that puts you on the state, on some sort of a dole, on a program that keeps other social workers and other people busy. You know, physical therapy means you stand in place and march. I was actually denied physical therapy because I was too old for it, and I needed physical therapy. I had to find it myself, and I had to implement my own program. Thank heavens I'm able to do that. But I'm finding that I had to fight the system. The system does not like me because I speak up. I'm an advocate for myself. And doggone it, I'm going to live a whole lot longer than they want me to because I am not going to a SNF.
Well, Kathy raises some points there, Andrew. Comments?
Well, part of what Kathy mentioned, she mentioned pain. And her pain being dismissed by medical providers. So I want to highlight that because that is quite common. You know, going back to the, it's not uncommon for medical providers to say things like, well, at your age, this is normal. You know, and that is particularly common for women to experience. So that's an example of how ageism might intersects with sexism, perhaps. So so that is quite common, and that's important to call out. So thank you to Kathy for advocating for herself and for older adults in general. Yeah, I think social work is a really important and valuable field. So a lot of us social workers are doing things to advocate against ageism. So, but I do hear what Kathy's saying, that the system is really not set up and designed for older people. And that's important to acknowledge.
She mentioned SNF, and I believe, for those who may not be familiar, I think that means skilled nursing facility.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
So there you go. Another point you make before we go back to the phones, you make a point about rationing. And I get, we've kind of, I think, talked about this, but maybe to define that a little more carefully or clearly.
Sure. Yeah. So, healthcare rationing is a controversial topic. So probably a clear example, if we think back to the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, there was concern that we would not have enough ventilators across the country. For example, the state of Alabama decided to ration ventilators on the basis of age. And that was later found to be an example of age discrimination. So a lot of times healthcare rationing happens on the basis of age because, you know, in a time of crisis, sometimes the healthcare system feels it needs to make decisions quickly to triage our resources, and making a decision based on age is a very quick way to do that. But I would say it's quite problematic, and we need to incorporate a wide variety of factors and really put the needs of each individual first.
Our guest today, Andrew Stewart, you can join in too with your questions as we talk about ageism in the healthcare field. Andrew, of course, assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee and as a licensed clinical social worker. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at ageism in the healthcare field with our guest, Andrew Stewart, assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee and a licensed clinical social worker. Great to have him with us, and great to hear comments from you as well as you listen in. Appreciate it. Barbara emailed us. She wanted to point out that Medicare does not cover annual physicals. What they will cover is something called an annual wellness visit, and that's probably what some of our callers experienced after age 65. And I think that's correct. I'm pretty sure that's correct, Andrew.
Well, that would make sense given the experiences people have shared on this show.
Yeah. Sam in Mellon, your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi, Sam.
Hi, good morning. My wife is a retired nurse practitioner, and she has a degree in human sexuality. She did her dissertation on how doctors treat sexual complaints in patients over 50, and basically it was that men got Viagra and women got lubricant, and that was it. And we haven't seen a lot of change. So I'd like for your guest to maybe talk about what he sees and how people are treated for sexual complaints.
Andrew? Mm-hmm.
That is a great point. Thank you, Sam, for bringing that up. And you're exactly right. You know, that's one of the stereotypes around aging. That's an example of ageism. Stereotypes that older adults are not sexually active.
This is Clara. Are you Susan?
So this is a really important topic.
Well, hi, Susan.
So there's a lot of ways that this is important. I think, you know, another example is inadequate care related to menopause for women and lack of understanding in some respects of experiences that men have as they age. As your guest mentioned, you know, for men, it's also just kind of prescribing Viagra. There's a lot of unique experiences men have as well as we age. So it's not an area that I've done extensive research on, but it is a critical area related to ageism.
Thanks again for that call. Carol in Madison, it's your turn.
Okay, I'm 51 years old. At 51 years old, I actually had an injury, and post-injury, I had gained 56 pounds. Now, the doctor I went into said, well, what do you expect? You're a middle-aged woman. And he hadn't looked at my history. I bicycled through Europe. I'm a canoeist. I swim anyways. And so it took 4 years to get the correct diagnosis. I had lymphedema from the injury. And the other speaker, the caller that said she was in pain, it could be because you have edema that's causing severe pain. And I actually was referred to a physiatrist, a doctor of physical medicine, after this other visit, and I wasn't happy with it. And she said if I didn't want to take drugs for my pain, that it was all psychological. And so she said she referred me to a psychologist, which was not available for 3 months, and I just decided I have to figure this out for myself. So I finally found an alternative doctor that referred me to OT for lymphedema treatment, and it resolved. Everything resolved. I've lost at least 50 of those pounds anyhow. And then when I was 70, I had another experience. Post J&J 9 weeks, I woke up one morning with a severely swollen right ankle and foot, couldn't stand on it. And I went into ER for it. And they basically said, well, there's nothing wrong, you know, and that nothing in my note was mentioned about the post-J&J vaccination. Since then, I've had one joint after another have severe swelling and deterioration, including a vertebrae coming out of position, so I could not even walk. I had to use a walker for 3 months, but I've resolved every single one of them. And my doctor, my new primary doc at about age 69, said, well, you're just wearing out.
Andrew, comment?
Yeah, thank you for sharing all of those examples. You know, a lot of examples that are very dismissive by medical providers. And again, going back to the pain being dismissed, I think that is really common. And again, I think some of those examples speak to the intersection of ageism with sexism, the way that people are treated differently based on both their age and their gender. And it's not uncommon for older women to, or really, I think all people, you know, for medical providers to kind of fall back on weight or BMI as well, rather than taking in a comprehensive assessment. So, thank you for sharing those examples.
As part of a solution, you know, we should talk about solutions here a bit, because you do talk about solutions. And she was demonstrating one solution in a way, and some others did too, in that they did some research and were not afraid to speak up.
Yeah, exactly. So I agree, you know, it's okay to tell your medical providers, you know, can you please talk with me and ask me what my preferences are for care? And you can tell them, you know, can you tell me any time that you're making a recommendation based on my age? I would like to know about that. I would like to contribute to the decision around the type of care that's provided to me. You know, anytime you're making a recommendation based on my age. And then other than that, for solutions, you know, folks, the onus should not all be placed on individuals themselves. So folks out there can know that there are ombudsmen, which are advocates for older adults in certified healthcare settings, nursing homes, et cetera. And they're really your advocate. You can call them, go to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services to look for your ombudsman in your area. There are also aging and disability resource centers. I would say they are the number one place to go to for a wide range of aging-related concerns. And then also, I think we really need to change our entire culture, our entire environments and healthcare settings. So some ways we can do this are, there's a national movement called Age-Friendly Health Systems that really are putting older adults' needs at the center of all decisions around care. And in Wisconsin, there's also the Consumer-Directed Care Network of Wisconsin. So really getting to more of a person-directed approach to care. So I think all of these things can also help, as well as individuals, you know, during their research and advocating and talking with their doctors, because we really shouldn't be putting all the burden on individuals themselves. We need to increase supports and change the entire kind of environment.
I'm wondering, and maybe you can talk about this, you did mention age-friendly health systems, but where do age-friendly healthcare systems exist, and how can you tell if an establishment is one?
Oh, that's a great question. So you can go to age-friendly health systems. You can go to the John A. Hartford Foundation search for John A. Hartford Foundation, Age-Friendly Health Systems, and they have a really useful map of the entire United States where you can just see all the dots across the country. I know we have several in the Milwaukee area. So that's where folks could go to see whether their healthcare practice is associated with an age-friendly health system.
Yeah. What kinds of cultural changes need to happen in healthcare?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of our healthcare systems, again, are kind of rooted in this biomedical model, which in part has led to healthcare systems being somewhat institutional, somewhat cold. Some ways we need to change our culture are, for example, I used to work at a retirement community in Denver that was really at the front of culture change. They embraced what was called an initiative called the Eden Alternative, which is part of a larger movement through an organization called Pioneer Network. But that was all about changing the environment and culture of nursing homes away from institutional setting to a home and community for people. What they say is that we can't just measure the success and the outcomes of healthcare systems, including nursing homes, through medical criteria. So they actually say in the Eden Alternative model that the real plagues in nursing homes are actually loneliness, helplessness, and boredom. So their approach is really all about promoting community, promoting person-directedness, promoting citizenship so that each individual within a healthcare setting has the opportunity to contribute. So these are some ways that we can change the culture in healthcare.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I read your paper. And by the way, we're going to put that map that you mentioned, we'll put that up as a link as well on today's page so that if people want to find an age-friendly health system in their area, hopefully they'll be able to see it on that link. And we'll put that up after the show, I think about an hour or so after the show is over, we'll have that up. And policy changes in the last minute or so, what kinds of policy changes should we consider?
Well, as I mentioned, there are a couple of legislation that people can advocate for. There's a Medicare Dental Vision and Hearing Benefit Act. There's the Medicaid Dental Benefit Act so that all older people can have access to receiving dental vision and hearing supports. And then I think we need to include older adults in clinical trials so that our healthcare recommendations and practices are really understanding the needs of older people that's rooted in research. We really just need to, I think more broadly, we need to think about the health of our entire kind of culture and to think about how important, you know, an indicator of the health of any culture is how we treat young people and elders. And so I really think we all need to reflect about that. Think about how we, what we believe about our own aging. And that's one step we can all take to changing the entire culture around aging.
Andrew, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Andrew Stewart, Assistant Professor of Social Work at UW-Madison, also a licensed clinical social worker. Obviously, we could talk some more about this, and we will down the road. Coming up, we're going to take a look at preventing falls. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to spend some time now talking with you about fall prevention in older adults. And we'll hear about some exercises maybe you can do to improve your balance. And a couple of guests for you. Susan Fricken is with us. She is a physical therapist at Yahara Therapy and co-founder of Ballroom Basics for Balance. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
With us as well, Jill Rankin. She's executive director at the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging. It's an organization with a goal to help people thrive as they get older. And Jill Rankin, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
As we talk with our two guests, I hope you'll join in. What kinds of exercises or what are you doing to maintain your balance? How are you keeping strong as you age and maybe preventing falls? Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jill, September is Fall Prevention Awareness Month in Wisconsin. And I guess my first question is, why do we need a month devoted to preventing falls?
Right. That's a great question. So we know that falls have serious consequences as we age, and our risk goes up with age. So it affects our families. Falls affects our caregivers, people, loved ones who are helping care for us, all the way down to our communities and our systems that help take care of us. So we know that more than 1 in 4 older adults fall every year. The CDC tells us that, so we know that that's increasing as the age is increasing of our population, as well as fall risk. So we need to do a lot. We know that falls can result in minor injuries or even major injuries. It results in hospitalizations, nursing home stays, or even death. But even just talking about those minor injuries or falls that don't have injuries, it really does lead to like worry about falling in the future. It just has a ripple effect. So it can lead to a loss in confidence, which then it leads to depression, isolation, physical decline. But the bottom line is that falls just definitely hurt our independence. It hurts our health and our finances. But the good news is that while it's common and while it's increasing, they're not a normal part of aging. Falls are not normal. There's a lot of steps that we can take to reduce our risk of falls. So really our goal is to help empower people to access resources and information that can help reduce their risk of falls.
You know, Wisconsin leads the nation in a lot of things that I'm kind of proud of, but I'm not as proud of the fact that we lead the nation in the number of falls for people 65 and older. That's one I wish we did not lead in. Why is it the case here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so really great question that we are continuing to work on. What we think is that Wisconsin does have a different and more robust reporting system than a lot of other states do. So that number may be skewed because we report our falls in a more complete fashion. So, but either way, nationally, falls are an issue. So whether or not it's Wisconsin, whether it's our ice, whether it's due to alcohol use or due to just in general physical decline, we know that it's a major issue and there's things that we can do about it. But here in Wisconsin, over 47,000 older adults went to the emergency department for a fall in 2022. And of that, about 10,000 people were hospitalized. So we definitely need to do something.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Susan, how does physical activity play a role in fall prevention, and why is it, and it's very important, I think, to have physical activity as we age?
Yes, and it's the same thing for us at all ages. It connects us to our body, so our joints are meant to move. We're built to move, and the more we're moving in different ways, different directions, the stronger we're going to be, the more our joints are going to be flexible. And also, when we move, we have to use our brains. And in my world, there's something we call dual tasking. It's doing two sort of moderately difficult things at the same time, usually one with your brain, one with your body. like dancing, for example, mm-hmm. one of my favorites. And it helps us to respond to our world. So, you know, if I'm doing the cha-cha sideways, for example, when I have to zip out of the way of something really quickly while I'm walking down the street, I'm going to be able to because I've practiced it. And so practicing moving helps us move better, basically. The other thing is, like Jill mentioned, we tend to get afraid. We lose our confidence. And then we forget that we can actually do things for ourselves. We can get up off the floor. We can, we have what it takes. And if we practice just a little bit, it doesn't take a lot, then we know, okay, we're going to be okay. I'm going to be able to handle this, or I'm going to be able to come up with a different strategy for getting through the world and enjoying it still.
Yeah, all good points. Richard in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how are you doing? I worked a lot more years than your guest speaker worked in fall prevention. It is very important to have physical ability to be able to step and get around something. But there's so many other variables that a lot of clinicians don't take into concern. And I'll give you an example. I had a doctor. I had three patients that came in with broken hips. And I'm reading their charts. And I'm trying to figure out why they fall in the middle of the night. And they fell because they prescribed them an over-the-counter medication to sleep because they weren't sleeping. That's a common thing amongst the elderly. They can't sleep. So they prescribe them that. And I have taken it myself, you know, to leave PM or whatever. And then you get up in the middle of the night and you're not steady. And I'm a healthy guy.
Comments on that, I guess either one of us. Susan, we'll start with you and then Joe.
Sure. That is true. That's absolutely true. Falls are multifactorial. So there are a lot of things that go into falls. And one of the things that's really important is if you're feeling off balance or you're falling, you should get screened by medical professionals like your primary care provider and geriatrician and also a physical therapist. We have a class that I teach and that Jill supervises overseas at Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging called Stepping On. And it includes exercises, but we also address all of these other factors. It's a whole person approach, and that's very true.
Yeah. And Jill?
Yeah, I will just address exactly what Susan said. We know that they're multifactorial. We know that medications play a big role in falls. So talking with your pharmacist and your healthcare team, your whole healthcare team, about all the medications that you're on, and not just medications, over-the-counter things that you're taking, supplements, all of those things can have interactions that can increase your risk for falls.
I can just speak one more time really briefly.
Sure, go ahead.
Each person has a different combination of factors. So it's really, really important that you know why you are having your issues. And yes, we can do classes and things and teach generally, but sometimes it's your foot strength. Sometimes it's your medication, plus it might be joint pain. So it's really important that people get screened.
Susan, you, as a physical therapist, what ongoing issues from falling do you see in your practice?
Broken bones, increased fear. A lot of times it feels like a cascade to people, and loss of independence, for sure. And so, I mean, just those alone are enough. And, if we're afraid the way that we fall is more prone to make us hurt ourselves. We get stiff and scared and rigid. I teach a class called Parkour for Seniors as well. And what we do, and a colleague of mine teaches a class on how to fall safely. If we learn falls resiliency as well as falls prevention, when we trip, and you know, I think I trip just about every day, it's how you land that makes a difference to how well you're gonna get back up and get into it.
Yeah. Rebecca, Jill, did you have a comment as well?
Yeah, I would just add to that too, is because as we get older, our strength and our balance, we have to work harder at it. So with not only having that resiliency in the way that we fall and the way that we move, but also just making sure that we're challenging our bodies enough to be able to have that resiliency is also very important. Strength is a big component to balance.
Yeah, we should all push ourselves no matter what our age. So those little teeny tiny weights are fine to start with, but we need to bump them up.
A Peg in Dodgeville emailed us. She started doing Pilates at age 56 after watching both her mom and a friend suffer broken limbs from falls. She knows that her core strength has improved, and she saved herself from falling injuries as a result. She recommends Pilates for older adults. Jill, what do you think?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Sign me up. Yes, yes.
And Susan, you're nodding vigorously. Oh,
yeah.
In agreement.
Vigorously. Yeah. Pilates. Yep. Pilates. And you don't have to do a giant class and go get machines. You can access Pilates in lots of different ways. They don't all have to be expensive or far away.
Rebecca emailed us wondering, do vibration plates such as those found at Planet Fitness type locations, do they help increase bone density? And could these be used to decrease the risk of broken bones if falls occur?
There is some research that shows that it might be helpful. I would say a multifactorial approach, again, for bone health is really important, from nutrition. Vitamin D, we know, is really important, in calcium. And so making sure people know what their bone health status is one of the things. But it is one thing that we're looking at that could be helpful.
Susan Fricken, physical therapist and co-founder of Ballroom Basics for Balance, and Jill Rankin, executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, our guest today. Maybe you've got an experience to share or a question to ask relating to falls, and I hope you'll join in. What's your experience been like? Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. As we mentioned earlier, September is Fall Prevention Month here in Wisconsin, and a couple of guests talking with us today about fall prevention. Susan Fricken, physical therapist, co-founder of Ballroom Basics for Balance, and Jill Rankin, executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging. And great to have both of them with us. And again, you can call in or shoot us an email. Email address talk@WPR.org or phone 800-642-1234. Barbara and Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I've just recently moved here from another state, New York, and I'm continually surprised about the lack of quality handicapped accessibility out in the public. There are so many opportunities to catch your foot. I mean, you'll have a handicapped parking area, and the ramp, will you have to go around the car. It's not readily accessible. You usually have to go over a curb. And also, the ramps are not at the same gradual slope as I found in New York. There's a huge difference here. And so when I'm out going around, it does impede my mobility, in the sense of I use my walker, which I actually around the house don't even use a cane. But I'm so afraid when I'm out in public, it just surprises me that I went recently to a newly opened restaurant in New York. They would have never have gotten the permission to open because they had ramps, but there were ramps that no one could possibly use that was handicapped accessible. And on the streets, I don't find people in motorized vehicles that, you know, need a scooter or something. Because you just can't use them out in the public in most places.
Barbara, thanks a lot. So she's talking about some physical barriers. Well, let's start with Jill. Jill?
Sure. Well, as we mentioned earlier, we do have a program called Stepping On that addresses many of these different factors that everyone is talking about. Very, very important. We do have part of that curriculum is addressing community safety and navigating our community safely. And a big piece of that is awareness. So it sounds like we've got some great awareness here, and as well as that resiliency that we keep talking about with our strength and our balance. So when we're encountering these challenges, then we can certainly navigate some of that with our resilience. And I will also say that on the other side of it, we do a lot of advocacy. So the Wisconsin Coalition for Fall Prevention really works a lot on advocacy issues. So this is really important to hear of people's experiences and definitely things that we work on a statewide level.
Yeah. And Susan, anything to add there?
Yeah, I just wanted to say Barbara sort of demonstrated something that's really important, which is she's making good strategic choices. So choosing to use her walker when she goes out so that she does prevent the fall and keep complaining about it to the right people. That's important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Skip and Milton, we'll go to you. Hi, Skip.
Hi. I just came in late on the show, but I got the general gist of it, and I want to make a plug for yoga. I started after I retired. It's been about 7 years now. I've been doing yoga. I was concerned about my knees. I wasn't even going to continue if it hurt my knees because I was having some knee issues. Ran too many marathons, I think. And after about 5 or 6 weeks of doing yoga, my knees were getting better. So I thought, wow, this is amazing. And now my knees are in better shape than they've been for at least 14 years, and I'm probably more flexible than I've been in 20 years, and I'm nearly 75 years old. So I'm just thrilled by the results of that. I walk 7 to 10 miles a day too, so that also helps. But just want to make a plug for yoga.
Skip, thanks. Susan, your comment there—you were getting excited when Skip was talking.
Oh, yeah. There's so many great things about yoga. And what I loved is that Chip had said his knees got better and he was going to quit. And the cool thing is, I mean, sometimes pain is something that's telling us to stop, but sometimes it means we need more. We need more strength. We need more flexibility. So I'm glad that he kept going. Yoga's got a lot to offer. And there's a lot of great research out of UW-Madison on yoga and falls as well.
Bobby and Rhinelander, we'll go to you. Hi, Bobby.
Hi there. Thanks so much for this program and the one last week about broken wrists, which I did falling while out hiking. My problem is being in too much of a hurry, and I can't do that anymore doing the hiking trails. So I need to realize that I need to slow down or there'll be a mistake. And the yoga comment fits right in. My question is about vision and how that plays a part. Our vision changes, and I feel like when I'm out, I don't have the right glasses on. Maybe you could address that. Thank you.
Jill, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, vision is a significant component to our risk factor for falls. We also know that when paired with hearing loss, then you have a kind of a double-edged sword there. So we do need to make sure that we are talking with our healthcare team about different vision changes, because just like strength and balance, our vision also changes as we get older at a faster rate than it did when we were younger. So yearly checkups with an ophthalmologist or whoever your healthcare team is that you choose to be able to do that is incredibly important.
Yeah. Bobby, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Martha in Menominee will give you a chance. Hi, Martha.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. Great show. When my father was getting on in years, his regular doctor was out of town. He saw a young geriatric intern who said the greatest thing. I think your audience would love to hear this. He said it was unacceptable for our culture to consider acceptable that old people fall down. And immediately we switched to this intern and things got better for my dad. But what I wanted to share with you is an experience I had. Don't wait women till you're 65 to get your bone density scan, because by then it might be too late with osteoporosis. So I wish I had gotten mine at 50. Now all the doctors can offer me is calcium supplements. What they really want to offer is a new drug that will actually replace bone loss, but there are a lot of risks. And again, I'm told, you know, at your age, you might not want those risks. So it's a double-edged sword. But I would suggest all women don't make the mistake I did and wait until you're 65 to get that bone density scan. Get it earlier so you can prevent anything that might be coming along. That's my call.
Thank you, Martha. Appreciate a comment on that. Well, Jill, start with you and get both of you involved. But Jill, you first.
Yeah, I would love the lessons. And it's a lot about self-advocacy and a lot about communication with our healthcare team. So, you know, asking for those things and advocating for yourself is incredibly important.
Yeah. Susan?
It's true. I recently got my bone density checked because of my history. And my doctor told me that insurance doesn't often want to cover it before then. However, that's where your doctor comes in. They will help to advocate if they think that you need it. The other thing about bone health is we know that exercise, kind of the topic of our show today, especially strength training, resistance, pushing, pulling, lifting, can help stabilize bone loss. And in some cases, even a little indication there might be a little reverse, depending on our age and our history and the rest of our health. So exercise and bone health, they go hand in hand.
Sid in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Sid.
Hi. After falling 3 or 4 times in my late 70s and not hurting myself, when I changed 80, I told myself one thing. I got to learn to act my age. And when I act my age, I go downstairs a little slower. I use handrails. When I'm walking down a sidewalk, I'm watching for variations that I might trip on, and trying to stay alert to those because I can't handle them as easily if I hit them. And there's just a number of things I learned that it helped me get over my pride. Oh, I won't fall. I take 3 1-mile walks a day. I'm this good guy. Baloney. You got to act your age.
Okay. Sid, thank you. Well, do you agree with that, Jill?
I do. I think we got to put the work in. So it sounds like that's happening here, which is wonderful. There's so much that we can do. And if we're all empowered to be able to do that, then let's do this. Take control of our health.
And Susan?
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I wondered... acting your age and there's acting your age.
I responded to that too, and I loved that comment. And it means what it means to you. I mean, if you're feeling like, you know what, the best thing for me would be to just pay attention, slow down, you know, not stop moving. Stopping moving is bad, will make us less able, but paying attention, being aware, just sort of admitting, hey, I've changed. What's in my head and what's happening in my body are a little different. They're a little mismatched. But acting your age, you know, here's my favorite story about acting your age. I'm at Parkour Senior. We're on the playground. Mary Jo is trying to flip over the bar. And Mary Jo said, wait a minute, I'm 74. In my brain, I'm still 40, you know, so we've got to sort of match ourselves with where we are. And like Jill said, bring up, play more, do more things with our body so that our brain and our body match a little bit better so that when we're moving around, we're not falling down the stairs.
Chris in Minneapolis has something a little different, I think, here. Chris, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Thanks. Well, this is a great show, and I love the work that you guys are doing, particularly with using ballroom dancing. That's wonderful to keep folks moving as they get older. I'm a figure skating coach in the Minneapolis area, and of course, we are the masters of falling down in that sport. And one of my colleagues is masterful at using a motorized spinner, And we use that to train the vestibular system of the athletes. So, for example, we train dizziness out of them. That way they can do, you know, 40 or 50 revolutions at over 4 revolutions a second, be put down and instantly regain balance and be able to catch an object, for example, things like that. Quite by accident, my colleague Sheila, who owns a company now called Vestibular Training Services, we found that with older folks, gently spinning them, and they're hanging in a, like a harness system so they cannot fall when they're on the motorized spinner. Research is currently underway on using a motorized spinner to train vestibular health, particularly as we know that that declines as folks get older. So I wanted to just ask if you guys were already aware of this stuff going on and get your take on it.
Oh, well, Chris, thank you so much for calling. Jill?
Yeah, that's new information as far as those tools go. So I'm going to have to look up and do some more research on it. But yeah, we do know that the vestibular system has slower reaction times as we get older, and that affects our balance.
That's the coolest thing. I wrote it down right away. Vision is 70% proprioception, or our sense of our bodies in space, is 20%, and vestibular is 10% of when they work well together. We have good balance and we have good response. And so just losing any little percentage of that is a big deal. Here in Madison, and there are other places around the Midwest, there are circus arts classes that here in Madison, my trapeze teacher is in her 70s and she trains women in their 80s. And that is a wonderful way to train your vestibular system also, but it's super important. And thanks so much for that phone call.
Yeah, appreciate it very much, Chris. We should get to ballroom basics for balance. I was thinking about growing up in my whole life, because my parents were really, really good ballroom dancers, the kind that other people would stop and watch them. And so we learned to love dancing and to dance from the time we were just little kids, and that's carried through our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're not necessarily training people how to rumba, perhaps, or samba.
Oh, sure.
or
oh, yeah.
Are you?
We are. Well, and the basics piece is sort of our little way of saying, okay, we can take this ballroom dance, and we also do other dances like disco or folk dance or line dance, but we do a lot of ballroom dancing because in ballroom dance, have you ever met a ballroom dancer or any dancer who's aged poorly if they keep dancing? No. And there's just so much in dance. But yes, we do rumba, we do samba, we do cha-cha, we do swing. Waltz is my absolute favorite for balance. There's so much in dance, including moving in all the different directions. That grace that I think you were talking about, Larry, where people just stopped and wanted to watch, that getting that our brains and our bodies to move well together. We take it and we break it into the pieces that we need. And whoever happens to show up in class, we make it fit for everybody. We have options. You can Roomba this way, you Roomba that way. Sometimes we partner, sometimes we don't. But there's a lot of really great research more and more every day about dance and falls and balance. And there's something really special about rhythm and music as well as movement that really, really helps us figure out how to move well.
Got an email from John who wonders, what kinds of strength and balance exercises are effective in preventing falls?
You want me to take it, Jill?
Go ahead, Susan, yeah.
So the good news is it's not much. It doesn't have to be a whole lot. So in stepping on, in other programs that we know about, exercise classes and in different movements, it's a lot of strength. So we know that strength, it has to have strength. We have to be able to have a variety of movement, and so we have to practice moving in different ways. And also something called dual tasking, what we mentioned earlier, doing two things at once that are kind of difficult and challenging. And we have to practice balance while we're standing still or sitting still if we don't stand, and practice balance while we're moving. We call it static balance and dynamic balance. And so strength is a big one, especially the hips, especially the thighs and the feet and the ankles. And as mentioned earlier, core is really important too. So what if you snack on exercises, which is my favorite way to say it, because I love eating and I love snacks, but snacking on exercises, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, if you do that all day, all week, all month, that adds up and it makes a difference. We know that 3 hours a week is what it takes by research. It keeps being shown over and over. And you can, instead of sitting in your chair, Larry, one time you sit down, I dare you to do it three times for everyone. If everybody did three times for everyone, we would get a lot stronger in our legs and we would be on our way.
Mm. Well, if I sit down to watch TV, I've got a couple of weights next to the couch. So perfect. I can pick those up and watch TV. And they're just lightweights, but they...
And you also made a really good point. So you can probably stand up and sit down three times easily. But if you have weights next to you, the other really important thing about improving your balance is you have to progress it. So if you can sit and stand three times and that's good, that means maybe you should pick something up as well. So everybody's going to be a little different. I love it.
So all these little bites that you're talking about, now what are some more examples of little bites that we should be doing?
Yeah. So little bites that you should be doing is when you're standing waiting for anything, instead of complaining that, oh, I got to wait for the teapot or whatever, put your hands on the counter and lift your leg up and down to the side or behind you. Step sideways instead of just going forward. That will make your hips stronger. So we've got little mini squats that you can do. Up and down on your toes and then lifting your toes. There is a series of 8 exercises that if you do those every week, it's been shown that your balance will improve. You know, if strength is one of your major reasons for balance issues. So these just little things, changing the way that you're already doing something, not feeling like you have to pile on new things. Do new things if you want to, but I challenge you to walk sideways down the hallway instead of forward. How about that?
Well, I can do that well because I, you know, that's part of dancing too, you know,
right.
You're sideways,
right.
You don't want to be running into other dancers.
And even better, put on some music and move to music. That'll make it even better.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say music too. I mean, you have the music activates a part of our brain that isn't activated without it. So when you talk about that strength training plus the music, then you're getting a double benefit.
Yes.
Ann in Duluth, Minnesota has something for us. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I made a discovery a couple of years ago. Some winter boots called Ice Bugs, ICEBUGS, and they have like little spikes built into the bottom of them. You can use them indoors. You can walk in from outside, inside, and you won't slip on a slippery floor. You can use them to drive. I have not even slipped on ice in like 3 years because of these boots. They are incredible.
Ice Bugs. I actually have a pair of, they're not boots, but they're like more like tennis shoes, Ice Bugs, that you cannot slip on them on ice. I've tried to slip with Ice Bugs and you can't slip with them. So a little ad for Ice Bugs. I wasn't paid for that, but Ann, thanks for calling. Any comment on that? Are you guys familiar with that? I mean, ice is a huge thing here in Wisconsin.
It is. But if you have good strength and balance, you should have that resiliency. But footwear is important, and that brings up a point. We know we need to have good support and grip on our shoes, on our footwear that we're wearing. There are things also called yak tracks, if anyone has heard of those, where you can just put it's a little device that you put on the bottom of your sole of your shoe, and that helps you so you don't slip on ice as well.
Yeah, it's a lot then cheaper, too, than ice bugs.
Yeah. I wrote that down. I'm going to follow up on that. Thank you.
All right. Our guest today, Susan Frick, and physical therapist and co-founder of Ballroom Basics for Balance, and Jill Rankin, executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, talking about falls and preventing them. And you can join in, too. Hope you do. If you have an experience to share, maybe a question to ask. Number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at falls with our two guests today, Susan Fricken, physical therapist and co-founder of Ballroom Basics for Balance, and Jill Rankin, executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging. Questions or an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a question from emails. How do you know when to get the medical attention, and when you might tell people to just shake it off?
I would say right away, because like we said before, we know from our statistics, even falls that don't have injuries attached to them are an indicator that there's something else going on that you can do something to prevent. So you can get a falls risk assessment from your healthcare provider, from a physical therapist, and Susan has more information on that. But it's, I would say right away, you start talking about it right away, because anytime you fall, you're going to have decreased confidence. You're going to have potentially increased fear that you're going to fall. And that then leads to more falls. We know that falls go from potentially no injury to all the way down to death. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. So the earlier, the better.
And Susan, to add to that.
Yeah, I agree. Part of it is, you know, it might seem irritating to have to go get checked out, but that one visit instead of 10 down the road would be much better. So making sure you didn't hurt yourself, and also maybe figuring out the why. There are really wonderful physical therapists who, a lot of them are neurologic PTs, so you can ask for a neuro PT. And these people specialize in falls screenings, so they can look over every possible reason, vestibular, you name it, reasons why you might have fallen, and then just help you work on it. So I'd recommend it.
Here's another email. Does using a standing desk at work improve balance and fall prevention? Jill, you're nodding yes.
Absolutely. I'll let Susan elaborate on that, but any movement and any strength that we can build.
Walking and standing alone do not prevent falls, however. Doing anything that strengthens, like Jill said, strengthens your legs more. So it can contribute for sure. Mm-hmm. Moving is the key. So if you're standing still, make sure you're moving around. Go up and down on your toes. Walk sideways while you're in the meeting that you don't have to listen that closely to. Stand up and sit down. So really, it's a lot of the movement. The push, the pull is really important.
I'm one of these antsy people anyway, so I'm up and down a lot just because I'm kind of antsy. John in Janesville, your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, just listening to your show today and some of your references to ballroom dance and physical abilities and agilities, you are so right on the money. We were in ballroom dance for a number of years, competed around the Midwest in it, and received coaching in the field. It's quite a, as you get a little bit older, it's quite a help in trying to develop your agilities, not falling. And I'm actually taking some classes right now from a physical trainer, and things like how to do leg strengthening as it goes away from you as you age, and how to fall and how to get up and how to stand up, and can you stand up without putting your hands on the floor? Can you actually stand up on your own accord? And what used to be no problem at 32, at 72 becomes a problem. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for calling, John. Susan, the comment from you first.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. So the dancing, the strength is a really big deal. And getting on the floor every day. I think, Larry, you had alluded earlier to something, but cultures around the world that sit on the floor, that squat to do work more throughout their whole lives have fewer issues than we do. And it's because we are getting up and down. So my recommendation is take as many of the chairs away as possible. Don't let your kids get used to chairs. So when they are older, they can get up and down off the floor with grace and with ease. It's one of the things, if you're in the hospital, I'm a physical therapist contributing to an evaluation. And if you, we're not sure if you can get off the floor by yourself, we might gauge you as not independent. So it doesn't have to be pretty. We don't care if it's pretty. We just want you to be able to do it. And it gives you confidence that you can do it. Thanks for that.
Yeah, I have some physical therapists on the show who come by once a month, and we talk about all kinds of PT issues. And we did get into that a little bit. And both of them said they themselves will just sit down on the floor at least once a month and get up. And just to okay, I'm pretty good at this yet, or whatever.
Even better, when you're in a meeting, sit on the floor. I want to challenge all the places with chairs to rethink this. See if we can sit down more, or little, at least short stools. I would like that. That would be better.
I watched Susan. I watched the video on your site and what website that's sort of showcasing your ballroom basics for balance. But one of the things I noted was it's not only helping your physically, but a lot of people in your classes remarked about the emotional. It changes how maybe how outgoing or just the human contact.
Yeah, it's true. And we had, you know, talked about social isolation, and I listened to the segment before. As well, that when you were talking with the social work professor, and it, what Jill said earlier is even if you're an introvert, even if you don't want to engage much, just being around other people, it does something to our brains. It does something to our spirit, and it does something to our desire to be in the world. And people have been surprised that that was the part that they ended up enjoying the most. We have a lot of intergenerational classes. We invite students to come and help us. And that's also a pretty big deal. Just being around. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up, because it's a really big deal. And it's one of the health indicators around our country right now. People over 60, falls and social isolation are two of the biggest health challenges we've got.
And it sounded to me, or it looked to me, like your classes are pretty popular.
They're popular. Yeah, it's great. They're so fun. We've got multiple classes around Dane County. We've got some in Waukesha. We've had people sneak in from other states even and train. And there are wonderful things like what we're doing going on around the country. So if people are listening in from other places, there are similar programs, and we can definitely help you find them. People are doing amazing things that are fun for you.
Yeah, for sure. Dan in Onalaska, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. One of the most valuable therapies for aerobics and for joint maintaining your joints and balance is called rebounding, which is just a little trampoline about 3 feet in diameter, and you just bob up and down on it. And you're using all of your stabilizer muscles to keep from falling down, and you're getting lymph fluid drained out, and you're not hurting your joints on this trampoline. But the G-force, the resistance, when you bounce up, is exercising every muscle in your body, every muscle, including the eyeball muscles and even your bladder muscles to help you with incontinence. It's the most fabulous exercise, and NASA said it's about 10 times more productive than jogging or any other form of aerobics, because you're using all of your stabilizer muscle, your core muscle. It's fantastic.
All right. Well, Susan, we'll go to you. Here, Dan is... is very enthusiastic about
you
rebounding.
You can hear his passion, and it's a great option. And the exercise that is correct is the one that makes sense to you and is fun. And rebounding is great. They make them with handles you can hold on to if at first you are a little worried about it, but it really is. It's everything he said. It's pretty great.
Jill, I want to go to mention your Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging website, too. It was fun for me to go on there, but you might talk about what's on there. I took your test, and I got everything correct. I got no for all of the questions you asked in one area.
Oh, good. Oh, that's so much fun. Yeah, so we have lots of resources. I think the one you're talking about is on our website, which is an assessment of how well we're aging. So how resilient are you and how is that? We also have a lot of resources specific to fall prevention. If you go to fallsfreewi.org, so fallsfree.org. And this is a brand new statewide initiative that we developed over the past couple years. And it has everything that we've been talking about today, plus more when it comes to figuring out what your risk is for falls specifically. So you can take a falls risk assessment and then learn more about all the factors that can cause a fall, how to reduce your risk. One thing that we didn't touch on yet today that I want to highlight is our homes and the environments that we live in. Because most falls happen at home. We know this. The statistics tell us that. So we have a home safety challenge that you can go into and you can, it's like a little video game. It's so much fun. You can go and you can click on the different risk factors that you might see in a typical Wisconsin home. It'll tell you how to adjust that. Maybe it's increasing lighting or removing a trip hazard or things like that. So there's lots of really fun things that you can do to check out at fallsfreewisconsin.org.
Yeah, lots of cool stuff there. Patty wanted to mention the program in Amherst, Wisconsin, through the Portage County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Their program's called Strong Bodies. So they're making use of weights, balance, movement activities. And it was originally designed to prevent osteoporosis, I think, but it says it's an excellent program. And could be even accessed through the Wisconsin Public Television website, too. So, and very inexpensive, which is another good thing.
We have that. Yeah, we have that listed on our website as well. All of the different physical activity programs that Susan was talking about, that Strong Bodies is on there, Stepping On, our falls prevention program, they're all listed on there. So you can access that on our website, fallsfreewi.org. There's, like Susan said, find what you love to do because there's so much out there. There's so many resources out there and we are just excited to help. So
these are the kinds of, somebody else wondered, okay, so what specific classes or programs should I attend to decrease my fall risk?
It's the fun ones. It's the ones, so the things you have to have are, it has to have some strength component. You have to practice balance while you're still and while you're moving. You have to have some kind of a dual task challenge. And think about things like racket sports, pickleball, badminton, ping pong. They help you get stronger, stop and start, go different directions. It can be as simple as that. It could be lifting your leg to the side while you're waiting. You can do your own program. It can be dance. We can help you, and this website will lead you to what are the things that need to be in a class. And it's these little lists of things, strength, and then challenging yourself in different variety of movement. It doesn't take much, but make it fun. Don't make it feel like
it's
like
work.
Torture. Yeah. Make it play. There's plenty of playful things out there.
On that happy note, I thank you both for being with us today. It's been a pleasure, and we'll have links to your websites on our program page today. So thank you both. Susan Fricken, physical therapist, co-founder of Ballroom Basics for Balance. Jill Rankin is executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging. Great to have them with us today. I hope we can do this again. Team effort for the show is our producers are Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, technical directors Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, our executive director Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.